This is Co-op Radio 102.7 CFRO, listener-sponsored radio in Western Canada. It is now just about 12 o'clock. Well, it's 11:59. In a matter of seconds, it will be 12, and then it'll be time for Animal Voices here on Co-op Radio. As I was coming down, I cut by Stanley Park, and there was all these ducks. They followed me down here and insisted on coming on the air.
Welcome everyone to Animal Voices. Yes, and thank you, Alan, for those sounds of the chickens. That's good little chickens enjoying themselves out in the wild. Many years ago, Howard Lyman came to Vancouver and he said, "No animal has to die for me to live." I was listening intently. In this program, Animal Voices, we seek to enlighten the general public on the animal-related causes. We, by presenting, producing radio programs that deliver a message that inspires people to improve the lives of animals. Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. This program is presented to you by volunteer members of the Vancouver Humane Society, Earth Save Canada, and the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. Alan Jensen is in the control room. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today, we have John Pranger. Hello, John.
Hi, Carl.
What will you be doing today?
We're going to be discussing aspartame, which is recently in the news, and it's safe if you're a rat.
What kind?
We don't know if it's safe if you're a human being, but who cares about that?
Okay, so it's a vivisection issue, animal experimentation issue. Thank you, John, for making these issues known to so many people. And also in the studio today, we have Hazel. Hazel comes all the way from Fort Langley to be with us today. And Hazel, what's your contribution going to be today?
Well, I'm going to be talking about chickens and raising chickens on the farm and feeding them all the hormones that we are also ingesting.
Hormones, yes. We want to know all about these growth hormones that make an egg produce from time they're an egg to a fully grown broiler, 6 weeks.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Is that with the help of hormones?
Yes, it is.
Well, we're going to hear more about that today, but shortly we're going to have a special holiday treat for you, Labor Day weekend today. It's we're going to have the Mad Cowboy on here, madcowboy.com. Howard Lyman is going to be, he's recently returned from Africa, and if you remember last week we had Dr. Ruth Heydrich on the show, and she told us, she just recently returned from Costa Rica, and she told us all about the fascinating animals, butterflies and caimans and exotics that she saw down there while she was jogging through the cane fields. Hi there, Ruth. She always listens. Thank you for listening and contributing so much towards the program. Yes, Howard Lyman came back from a tour of Africa and many game parks, and you'll be hearing many of his impressions within a few minutes. It's been said that there is no such thing as a meat-eating environmentalist. The meat and dairy and egg industries are indeed poisoning and depleting our land, water, and air. Every time we eat animal products, we contribute in many different ways to ecological devastation. Tough words to use. And wasteful misuse of resources on a global scale. Yes, there is a solution to this. You too can do a part and stand up to this destructive meat industry by adopting a vegetarian diet. Taking the meat plunge, the meat-free plunge, has never been easier or more essential than it is today. With so many vegetarian options, eating green, green is clean. Green, eating green has never been more delicious. There are so many good books out there. Dr. Ruth Heydrich put out a book called Senior Living. And Howard Lyman has a book called No More Bull, and it has many recipes in it. And so it's not only green, it's good for your health, and also it takes care of the animals. You indeed have the power to change the world simply by changing what's on your plate. Well, the global warming has been very much in the news recently. I don't think it's being questioned too much that, in fact, that this is a fact that is staying with us. Hurricanes on the east coast and on the west coast of Mexico. But when you munch on a burger and bite into a drumstick or chew on a pork chop, you're having tremendous effect, deleterious effect on the environment. Our hunger for meat is the biggest single contributor to planetary degradation. Be it global warming, fossil fuel depletion, water pollution, or desertification, meat consumption is a prime contributor to the global warming problem. In April, researchers at the University of Chicago showed that a person eating an average American diet contributes the equivalent of about 1.5 tons more CO2 to the atmosphere each year than does a person on a vegan diet. That's more than the difference between driving a Hummer H3 and a Toyota Prius 5,000 kilometers in the city. So global warming is part of our world gestalt. It's also, so is the extinction of many of our wild animals. Well, many years ago, as I said in our editorial in the beginning, Herman Lyman came to Vancouver and he said, "No animal has to die for me to live." Well, I became an instant vegan. I had been a vegetarian for 15 years. I became an instant vegan 15 years ago. We owe a great debt to Howard Lyman. He's the author, has a book called, he wrote Mad Cowboy, and his latest book, No More Bull. MadCowboy.com. Welcome to Animal Voices, Howard. Hi there, Howard.
You and my Canadian friends.
Thank you. It's always good to hear from you. Well, you know, you've just recently returned from a whirlwind tour of Africa, and so many animals you saw there. What would you say maybe was, just give us some of your main impressions of what you saw in Africa?
Well, Carl, you know, I'd always wanted to go and see the wild animals in Africa, and I thought if I didn't do it now, I probably never would. And so my wife and I, our daughter, her husband, and his mother all decided that we would go and spend a couple of weeks in Africa, and we'd go for two reasons. Number one is we wanted to see the wild animals in their own habitat doing their own thing. And the other thing is we wanted to see the people of Africa and see how they were doing. So we got on a plane, flew from New York to Dubai. We had a five-hour in Dubai, and so we thought, what could be better? And we would rent a car and go and take a look at the city. Now, Dubai is one of the fastest-growing cities in the Middle East, and I tell you, I was just absolutely blown away when I went there. Number one is that it was about 4 degrees centigrade when we landed. And so you can tell this old Montana farm boy, it was plenty warm. But we went out and took a look at this city, and believe it or not, we went to a mall where they had a mall where they had a ski run. They were making 600 tons of snow a day. People could go in and rent all of the ski equipment, and then for $140 for every half hour, they could go skiing. Just absolutely the epitome of humans taking the environment and moving it in the wrong direction. So anyway, we got rid of seeing the city of Dubai, went back to the airplane, got on the airplane, and we sat on the airplane for 3 hours with no air conditioning, with the plane broken down and waiting for them to get it fixed. Was 127 degrees Fahrenheit on the runway. Finally, we got the plane cranked up, and instead of going to Nairobi where we were supposed to go, we actually flew to Uganda, to Entebbe, and finally got to Nairobi at 1:30 in the morning. Well, needless to say, we had missed all of our connections. Spent a night in Nairobi. Finally, the next day, caught another airplane and flew out and met up with our guides so that we could go and see the animals. Our first thing is to go out into the Serengeti. And this is part of the migration right now. And we saw thousands of wildebeest, zebras, buffalo, hundreds of lions. We saw a few leopards, a few cheetahs. It was an amazing thing, Carl, to actually go and see the animals where they basically had no fear of humans in vehicles. But I'm afraid if we'd ever stepped out of the vehicles, they'd have had us for lunch in a heartbeat. But it was interesting to see a field. You know, I'm a farmer, and I looked out there, and here's a grassy field, probably somewhere 10,000 acres in that field. The grass is between 3.5 and 4 feet tall. Hundreds of thousands of wildebeest moved into that area, and by the end of the day, that 10,000 acres looked like it had been mowed with a lawnmower. And so the wildebeest and the zebras on the Cape Buffalo were moving for north, going from Tanzania into Kenya. But for me, to be raised entire life in agriculture, to be able to see the wild animals living as nature intended, the wildebeest, for example, 25 years ago, the number of wildebeest was down to about 250,000. Today, with humans not involved in their slaughter, there's almost 1.35 million wildebeest that move every year in Africa from south to north, following the grass and the rain, and moving south again to end up having their young. And believe it or not, wildebeest, when the young are born, within 15 minutes, a young wildebeest can actually run with its mother. One of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. So, for me, a trip to Africa was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I was glad that I went and saw it, and I would hope most humans would stop and think that we have companions on this planet. Those companions are here to give us the joy of seeing them, of interacting with them, and when we actually start eating them, we're killing the animals, but they're killing us. And so that was my impression, Carl, of going and seeing the animals for the first time.
I wonder if you could elaborate on the Serengeti, because it's the plains are so enormous. I mean, it's like looking at the ocean. It's totally flat. And then was also the one marvels of nature is that when you said that the by the evening the grass was all done, but different animals eat different parts of the grass. Is that correct?
Well, of course. You know, when we when we flew in, we flew over the Serengeti for an hour and a half before we got to where we were going to start our tour. And here it was, just hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres, as level as a billiard table, with grass that's anywhere from an inch tall to 4 feet tall. And the surprising thing about it is that animals in the Serengeti live with each other for a specific reason. The wildebeest, for example, have very poor eyesight, but the zebras live with them that have extremely good eyesight. The zebras like to eat the top of the grass. And what they do is the zebras move in, they eat the top of the grass, allow the wildebeest shorter grass so that they can see the lions. Then the wildebeest come along and they eat the grass that the zebras have left. Everything that I saw in Africa was there, and it was in balance. I saw the lions in the wild hunting warthogs, one of the most amazing things that I've ever seen in my life, to watch a group of female lions go out, and one of them became the object for the warthogs to see, where the others snuck around behind them. They were part of the kill party. The other one was there strictly as a distraction. I learned that when lions go hunting, 3 out of 4 times when those go hunting, they end up with no prey at all. If they go more than 3 or 4 days without being successful in the hunt, there's a good chance that the younger and the weaker ones will die. So here we have the Serengeti. Mile after mile after mile of grass. The important thing about it is not only the water. You go to the water, and what's there? Here we have crocodiles there at the water waiting for the animals that they know that have to come there to drink. And the crocodiles, they end up getting their meal with the animals that come to water to drink, because they know that they're going to have to come there. We end up seeing the rhinos and the hippopotamuses, the hippos. One of the most amazing things that I saw when I was there, Carl, is there were a pod of hippos that were in the water. The water was probably 5-6 feet deep, and here were all of these hippos together in a great big group, and on the back of one of the hippos was a crocodile sunning himself on the back of the hippo. Some of the people that had spent a lifetime in Africa, I asked them if they'd ever seen that before. They had to admit to me that they'd never seen it. But, you know, here it was, a small croc on the back of a large hippo. The hippo had no concern about it at all, because when you see those hippopotamuses, when you ask about where they're going to go, they go anywhere they want to go. The surprising thing about it, there are more people killed in Africa from hippos than lions, leopards, cheetahs, you name the animals, even the Cape buffalo. The hippo is the one that is the greatest threat to humans. So for me to go and to see this area that was unbelievably large, make Texas look like a postage stamp. The grass, unbelievable, because there's been good rain this year. And to see those animals, how they would come in, the zebras would take the top off, the wildebeest would take the bottom of it, and then they would move north again. Lots of grass when they showed up in the morning. By the end of the day, there was no grass left. They had to move again the next day. An amazing night.
Now, nature is such amazing that the zebras are able to defend themselves too. As you said, they have such good eyesight. And the wildebeest, when they cross the river, their eyesight is so poor, they might choose the widest part of the river to cross. But these zebras, they each zebra is different. The color markings, I mean, that's amazing. It's like our fingerprints. We think we're unique.
Well, the surprising thing about it, Carl, is not only is each zebra unique, there are two different species of zebra. One of the species has a white belly. Every one of the zebras, black and white stripes, but their belly was white. The other variety of zebra, the stripes went all of the way from the top of their back all the way down through their belly. Never noticed that until it was drawn to my attention. But to see the wildebeest, and like I say, the wildebeest have terrible eyesight. They are extremely fast, extremely agile, but they don't see very well. And when they come down to the river, and you will see wildebeest coming down in the thousands, and a line of them that will go several miles long, that may be 20 or 30 wide, and up to 3 to 5 miles long. They come to the river, they jump in the river, and you look at it and you'd say, well, the easiest way across is just to turn a little to the right. It's the shortest distance, but not the wildebeest. They just jump in and start swimming until they hit the other bank. And sometimes when a crossing would be only something like 20 yards, they would end up swimming over 200 yards where they got across the river. And guess what was waiting at the crossing? Crocodiles. And the crocodiles didn't even have to kill the wildebeest, because enough of them drowned in the passage that there were, numerous dead wildebeest floating in the water. I saw crocodiles that were 12, 14 feet long that were so full of wildebeest that they never even paid any attention to the ones that were crossing. The number of dead ones that were there, there were up to 50 to 100 condors sitting there waiting for the butcher birds to come along to open up the wildebeest so that they could eat them. It was an amazing thing, Carl, to see how nature takes care of every species.
We're talking with Howard Lyman, who's just returned from Africa. Howard Lyman, it's madcowboy.com is his webpage. Howard Lyman, you know, you went to the Serengeti and you've told us about the Serengeti, but you also went to some other game parks. How do they compare, and which one would you recommend as being the most noteworthy?
Well, we started out and we went to the Serengeti, then...
Oops.
Hello, are you there, Howard?
Yeah, we seem to have lost Howard Lyman here. Anyway, what a wonderful discussion there with Howard, and the line has gone dead. So... yeah, are you back? Anyway, no. So one of the most wonderful sites of Africa is, of course, the acacia tree, and the other tree called the it's called the upside down tree, with a very wide stem, bark. And anyway, many
Hi
years.
There.
Hi there, Howard. Sorry
How
about
doing?
That. We seem to have lost you for a few minutes there, and you were just beginning on the different, telling us about the different game parks. Are you there?
Yeah, well, we started out in the Serengeti, then we went to a place that was called Masai Mara, which was right on the edge of where the Masai tribe of Africa lives, and there was an amazing... amount of difference between Serengeti and Masai Mara. There were fewer animals in Masai Mara. It was a smaller space, but some of the things like leopards and cheetahs we were able to find there. Then we went from there to Ngorongoro, which is like a big crater in the mountain, and you never saw so many people in all of your life. There were so many Land Rovers out there looking at the animals that the dust in the air made it look like it was Los Angeles, California, and smog. So then we went there to a place called Samburu. Samburu, without a doubt, had the greatest amount of animals that were there. I actually saw a leopard that was no more than 5 feet away from me. We saw a cheetah with her four cubs sitting on top of a termite mound that was close enough that you could throw a rock and hit it. I saw a rogue bull elephant with only one tusk that was an amazing animal. You talk about huge. And he didn't care about anything in the world except going where he wanted to go. And if you were in his way, he'd walk right over the top of you. And it was an amazing thing to see a wild animal like that, to see the elephants up close enough that you could actually tell the difference between the male and the female by the shape of their head, to watch them use their trunk to pull the grass out. And when they couldn't pull it out with their trunk, then they would take their foot and kick the grass with holding onto it with their trunk and tear it out of the ground. So we were able to go to about five different places in Africa between Tanzania and Kenya. I would say to anybody that is considering going, I would do it sooner rather than later. The amount of people, I just happened to read in USA Today yesterday that the largest income producer in Kenya right now is tourism, going to see the wild animals. The number of people that are going there right now is almost unbelievable, and I do not know how long it's going to be before they totally change the way the animals act because of the amount of people that are going there. But it was a monumental event in my life to be able to see it and see the animals in the wild.
Howard, you also mentioned the different peoples that live there. And, of course, one always thinks, when one thinks of Kenya and Tanzania, one thinks of the Maasai people. How did you find them? How did you did you meet any of them?
Yes, I did. One of the things when we decided to go, one of the things that was high priority for me was to actually go and see the animals and the people. I did not want to see the people in a tourist setting where you would end up with everybody prearranged and to show you what they thought you wanted to see. What I wanted to do is I wanted to go to a Maasai village and one that was not expecting it, and to show up and see whether we could make an arrangement with them to go and see how they lived. Well, there was a Maasai village that was close to the road when we were in Tanzania. And so I said to the guide, I said, can we go to that village? And he said, well, I don't know. We can go try. So we went over, and we actually found one of the junior elders that was there that spoke exceptionally good English. He'd been to school. Asked him if we could actually come and meet the people in the village, that we could see how they lived, and he agreed to let us do that. Amazing thing for me is I learned that every one of the houses in a Maasai village is owned by a woman. They build them, they own them. When they end up with the young children, they basically herd cattle and goats until they get old enough to the point where they have a ceremony where they circumcise the young males, and from that time on, they are considered to be warriors. They spend the next 10 or 12 years of their life basically protecting the village, doing those things that are necessary so that the people that live there do not have to worry about being attacked by the animals or other people. When the young warrior reaches a certain age, he then becomes a junior elder, and at that time he is allowed to marry. Well, to marry, you have to have a certain number of cattle so that you can pay the dowry so that you can end up with a wife. We were able to meet some of the warriors. We met some of the junior elders. We met some of the senior elders. One of the senior elders actually showed me how they start a fire. And, you know, he didn't have a bit lighter. He didn't have a match. All he had was a couple pieces of wood and a string, and he ended up with these two pieces of wood, rubbing them together, causing enough friction that they were able to, inside of 2 minutes, he was able to start a fire. I actually got the opportunity to go inside of some of the houses that the women owned. The floors were
cow dung.
Cow dung and dirt, hard as a rock. Their beds were about 4 inches off of the floor, hard as you can imagine. The only thing that they had to sleep on were cow hides. But the amazing thing about it, they were extremely clean. We met a number of the women. They actually came out and my wife and my daughter and to end up having a conversation with somebody that did not speak English and we didn't speak Maasai was interesting, because everything was done with sign language, and we had a good time. We laughed. We were able to meet people that didn't have much when you look at our society, but if you look at their society, they were extremely happy. They had everything they needed. They enjoyed interacting with each other. And for me, going to that Maasai village was extremely interesting. So that was the natives, and then I wanted to know, how did the other Africans live? So we're driving down the road. I said to the guide, I said, can we go in this town right now and go to the market? And he said, sure, we can go there. He said, we hadn't planned that. I said, that's exactly why I want to go there. We went to the market, and the food that was available, you know, rice, beans, onions, peppers, you name it. The food that was there was extremely good. Ended up, most of the people there did not speak English, but wonderful time interacting with them. We got to look at their food. The children were one of the most interesting things I've ever seen. I never saw a child in Tanzania or Kenya that ever asked a tourist for money.
Mm.
They basically asked for only two things. One, candy, and the other was a pen. If you had a pen, a ballpoint pen, and they would ask you for a pen, if you would give them a pen, it was like it was the greatest gift in the world. I'll never forget, one of the young boys came up to my wife and asked her for a pen. She had one, so she gave it to him. He took it, and the first thing he did with it, he took the pen and he worked on his hand to see whether it worked. And boy, I'm telling you, when it worked, you never saw such a wonderful smile in your life.
Howard, I'm sorry.
All of the time that we were there, that young lad, he looked at my wife like she was the greatest thing in the world, because he gave her what he really wanted, which was a pen.
Howard, it sounds as if people are able to maintain their lifestyles. Are they doing that deliberately and resisting westernization, or is it out of necessity that they cannot change?
Well, the first thing, the Maasai, they want no part of changing their society. They are the only tribe in Africa that has maintained their land. Interesting thing about it, the Maasai believe that all of the cattle in the world belong to the Maasai. And so when they go out, and what we would call in, in our part of the country, cattle rustling, rounding up somebody else's cattle. Number one is they will never steal cattle from another Maasai, but they believe that all of the cattle that are not owned by Maasai really belong to the Maasai. And so when they end up what we would call stealing cattle, and the law takes them to court, their defense is that all of the cattle in the world belong to the Maasai, and believe it or not, they do not lose in court for stealing cattle. They don't want to change their society. They really like the way they live. They like knowing that they own the land of the Maasai tribes, and they want to keep it that way. Now, when you look at the other people, the other tribes of Africa that have changed, I'm telling you, it's a tough life. There is no welfare system at all. If you do not provide for yourself and your family, you starve to death. And that was one thing that I learned there immediately. Everybody that I met in Africa from the tribes that had westernized themselves, there was no such thing as waste. If you took, for example, somebody that had had bought a can of stuff, and when they emptied it, if they set that down, I'm telling you what, somebody would collect it in a heartbeat. There was no such thing as something being thrown away, because everybody was using it. The one thing that I came away from Africa with was that they are a very happy group of people. They don't have a whole lot, but they are improving their lifestyle. Their kids are going to school. They're doing better every year than they did the year before. They're proud of their governments. They're proud of their leaders. And they actually believe they're going in the right direction. I would say that there's a lot of places in America that could take heart from seeing how people in Africa are living.
Howard, thank you very much for giving us such a wonderful insight into your trip and you and Willow Jean, and about the animals and the peoples, and for always being ready for us to convey your wonderful message of optimism about the animals and the people all over the world. Howard Lyman, thank you very much.
It's been a joy, and for all of my friends in Canada, we're getting around to fall. It's going to be nice and cool and wonderful, and may the best of the season be with you.
People can get your once a month or so newsletter. Maybe you can just give us the webpage.
Yeah, if you go to my website, madcowboy.com, you can sign up for our free newsletter that comes out about once a month. It's the best information that we can find available on diet, environment, animals. And just go to madcowboy.com and you can sign up there for a free electronic newsletter.
Thank you, Howard.
You're welcome, Carl. Have a good day.
Thank you. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org. And John, you've just been redoing the webpage there. How's it going?
Oh, I'm so lazy, Carl. Which is, reminds me, I wouldn't mind if somebody took the job over. Anybody out there who is into making an artistic website for us, please give us a call.
But the past programs are still available. Well, within a few minutes, we're going to have a story from Hazel here. But and over to Alan, and we're going to have a little tune. Do you have something ready for us, Alan?
Yeah, I put on a bit of African music, thinking it would be a good segue into whatever happens next. So
right.
Let's hear a little music from Mali.
Mali.
That's music with Kati Tangara from Mali. Wonderful music. Hearing Howard Lyman reminded me of I was in Africa about 2 years ago in Ethiopia, and much of the time was up in the mountains and the high plateaus of Ethiopia, which is a completely different world from when you go to the south and you get down to the valleys, to the Great Rift Valley. And then that continues just down to the area where Howard was. I mean, this runs from Ethiopia down to Kenya, and it carries on down through to Tanzania. It just drops precipitously off from the Ethiopian plateau down to that low area. And so for part of the time, we were in the Great Rift Valley, just to the north of Kenya. And we were in a game park in southern Ethiopia, but it wasn't anything like the ones that Howard was talking about. In terms of vast numbers of animals, there was lots of antelopes around. Under every tree you'd pass, and there wasn't many trees because it's really, really dry country. But there's a lot of thorn trees, and then every little once in a while, you know, there's a little stand or an odd tree that's a little larger. And under any of the larger trees, there'd be an antelope just kind of standing, getting some shade. And with these incredible long curly horns, some of them these long twisted straight horns, and others with big curved horns, and just kind of standing there watching what was going on. And what we, in terms of large numbers of animals, it was the domestic animals. People who live there have camels, and some of them have hundreds of camels. And you see just, it was almost like Howard was describing the wildebeest. Not quite, but there was really a lot of camels in some areas as people were moving from place to place and moving their herds of camels. That they have to move, obviously, from season to season to where they can find grass for their camels to eat. Anyway, that's just a little...
Thank you there.
It's another segue.
And you've been to Darfur and Ethiopia, Alan?
No, well, not Darfur is in Sudan, right?
Okay.
It's over the border to the west of Ethiopia. So we didn't get over to the west. It's a little dangerous in that part of the country, really. The south was
dangerous animals or people?
People animals, human animals, right? Yeah, human animals. You have to be on your toes. Even in the south, where you have to watch it when you're out in the countryside, up in the mountains and the highlands of Ethiopia, it's not dangerous unless you run into a stray bullet or something from
a rebel gun.
Yeah, right. Or from an army gun. Right?
Army gun.
Not the rebels aren't the danger, it's the armed forces.
Thank you, Alan. And we're going to go over to Hazel.
Back to the farm.
And we're going to hear about chickens. When we're through with Hazel, we're going to be, during the break, we discussed hippos. And
how they kill you.
And yes, and crocodiles. So John and I have a little story.
Oh, I saw hippos and crocodiles too, so I can get in on that too.
Okay.
In Ethiopia, there's...
So we'll have to extend the program. And over to Hazel.
Okay, thanks, Carl. I would just add a little story to tell everybody. It's about farming, and I was a hobby farmer, and I raised chickens for the meat, and this was many years ago. The chickens that you are eating are full of hormones, and let's just say, for example, before I get into my story of my farming, you're going to the grocery store, and let's say you're going to have a nice chicken dinner tonight. It's Friday, and it's a long weekend. You might want to have a barbecue, and so if you're thinking of getting some nice chicken, you go to the store, and you're going to buy yourself some nice fat chickens that are sitting there all wrapped up in their cellophane. And, people don't think that that really is or was a living animal that had bright little eyes and drank and enjoyed the sunshine and liked to have little dust baths out there in the dirt, there on the farm, in the paddock there. And they end up becoming pets. So you get your chicken, you get it home, you take it out of the cellophane, you're going to get it all ready to cook, and take a break and take a look at it and look at the anatomy of this animal that you're going to be eating, and you'll notice that even though it's a nice big fat animal, I don't know how much they weigh, I don't know, 4 pounds or something, they have these little teeny weeny legs. And take a good look at those little legs that those fat little chickens have, and you'll have to realize that that is not a normal thing. you know, when we raised our chickens, they, you know, you start them a little chick and you put them on this feed, and it's called a starter, and it's for little chicks, and they eat, and I'm not quite sure if there must be some kind of hormone in that too. I'm not quite sure about that part, but they do eat continuously, eat, and before you know it, I think it's 2 weeks, they're big enough to go on the grower. And the grower is the food that has the hormone in it, and it makes these animals grow very fast and makes them eat continuously. Eat and eat and drink. And, you know, we were also very happy and gleeful and rubbing our hands together that our chickens are getting nice and fat. And
pooping all the time.
Yes, there was lots of poop going on. And anyways, 2 weeks of this, you have them on this grower, and they become very big. And that's when we noticed, because we were just starting farming, we were just novices, that the chickens were becoming crippled. And they couldn't make it to their little feed dishes and their bowls of water that we had all over for them. And they were hobbling along, and some of them could still walk, but some of them were crippled, and they could not get up, and were wondering, what's wrong with these chickens? And first of all, we thought maybe the predators had gotten them, and, you know, the rats had bitten their legs or broken their legs or something. But no, it was they just got so fat, so big, so fast, that their legs did not grow fast enough to hold up their bodies. And we would actually be picking them up, the ones that couldn't walk, and, you know, taking them to their water and sitting them right by the food where they would just sit there all day and eat. Just sit there all day. And so we would have them on that for 2 weeks, and then we would put them on another feed, which was called a finisher. And this is the one that cleanses all the hormone
so
out of cleans all the hormone out of the chicken chickens. That's when all the pooping starts. And they drink a lot of water, and you're supposed to give them a lot of water. We were told, you know, give them lots of water because they're getting cleansed, and you don't want to ingest this hormone in your own body, you know. And so 6 weeks, they're only left to be 6 weeks old, and then you have them, you know, slaughtered. And
so you were actually carrying them, these chickens, to the feed troughs and the water troughs.
Some of them, yeah. The other ones were hobbling around.
Like, imagine that wouldn't happen on a factory farm with tens and tens of thousands of chickens. There would be lots of casualties.
It's horrifying. You know, we had a nice little chicken coop thing with grass, and we used to feed them other things too, you know, like the lettuce from the leftover salads and, you know, stuff from the kitchen. But yeah, I think one of the reasons why they must keep them in those cages is because they do become crippled. They become gain this weight so fast that their legs can't hold them up. And of course, they don't want them moving around. We were taught you don't want them moving around because they'll lose weight, and they will become tough. Their meat become tough. So they want to keep them in these cages so their meat will be tender. And
that's usually the egg layers, isn't it? Only? Or the broilers also get into cages?
Yeah, that was probably, yes, of course they would do that too.
But of course, the egg layers will also be eaten at the end of their lives, so it's certainly a point that you're making.
So Hazel, now, thanks for telling us about this. I'm not licking my lips on any KFC cruelty here, but Pamela Anderson said if people knew how KFC treat their chickens, they'd never eat another drumstick. But what's the lesson for you?
You know, the lesson was for us was it was a real eye-opener. We wanted to become farmers and raise our own meat, and now we're realizing you don't have to eat meat all the time. And the lesson was that the meat that you are eating is... I never ever looked at it like it was an animal when I went to the store to buy meat for my family. I just looked at it as meat. I never thought of it as an animal. So I guess the lesson was this is a life that's given up for you to eat, and it's a creature. And in that, you know, if you are going to eat meat, that you should be respecting the life that was given up for you to have life.
What about the feed? Can you tell us something about the feed, like the ingredients? Do you know?
I don't know. I never paid any attention to the ingredients. We just went, you know, we bought our feed from Buckerfields, and they were the ones that would say, this is how you do it, and this is, you know, here's the feed, here's the starter, the finisher, the grower and the finisher.
Thank you, Hazel, for telling us your personal experiences. And yes, chickens are indeed inquisitive and interesting animals. and are at least as intelligent as pets called dogs and cats. When in natural surroundings, not in factory farms, they form friendships, they have social hierarchies, recognize one another, and recognize the people who come in.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
They love their young. I mean, you see how the young come creeping. They always have this image of the chickens, the chicks, going under the wings of the mother hen.
May I say something, Carl? We had a big, big rooster, and he was a scary guy because he used to beat everybody up, but he was a good rooster because he protected the chickens in the coop. And one day I went into the barn, and he was sitting in the barn, and he was sitting kind of weird, like funny and all puffed out and just sitting there. I thought, uh-oh, what's going to happen to our rooster? And when I got closer in, he had a whole bunch of little pullets. So they're not chicks, and they're not chickens yet, but they're pullets. They were our little chicks that we had raised for eggs, and he had them all underneath him, and it was around October, and I guess they were cold, and he was sitting there, and he had them, his big wings all out, and he was sitting all funny and puffed up, and he had them all in a couple of little heads would peek out from underneath his wings, and I thought that was so beautiful.
Nice. Animals living in their natural conditions, and I've personally seen how a hen raised some ducks they gave. The hen, and of course, the ducks went into the water.
The duck raised the chickens, the chicks.
It was also the other way around. I saw that in Indonesia.
Oh.
And of course, the ducks went into the pond, and the hen was somewhat, observing this, and she went in knee deep.
Oh, that's great.
If my babies can do that, we have exactly 2 minutes left. So you are more familiar with the ducks raising chickens, is it?
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, animals living together. John, did you want to just say something about aspartame?
Well, I don't know that we have time, but
give us the latest.
Yeah, okay. The latest in the news, of course, is that aspartame has been cleared and it's safe. But they're ignoring a study on 1,800 rats that were supposedly reported by Italian scientists last year, and it caused a great big stir. But the aspartame caused lymphomas and leukemias, but only in females. So you have to be a rat and you have to be a female in order for this stuff really to... This is what they're saying. So they're saying that epidemiological studies, which they've done now, this huge study, but it's only looking at one specific thing, namely brain cancers. We don't know what else this epidemiological study is. They were only looking to see whether, in fact, in people it caused brain cancer. And they came to the conclusion that it didn't. But, of course, there are lots of people who are skeptical of that, and they say that the study was no good and all this, and they're relying on the animal experiments. So, you see, science is nothing but a strange creature which nobody can make head or tail of because nobody knows who to believe.
Well, John, we're almost out of time here, and we'll have to have a full program on that. And you've been listening to Animal Voices. Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and yes, many of our programs are posted there. What would you go to archives, or what is it called?
It's called Past Programs.
Past Programs. So thank you for doing that. And Howard Lyman, who was on most part of this program, I found it so fascinating, him talking about my beloved Africa, and we have some stories which we haven't had time for about hippopotami and rhinoceros, and for another day. So Howard Lyman came to Vancouver many years ago, and he said, no animal has to die for me to live. And we were listening, EarthSave was listening, and there was an audience there, and he changed the way we looked at the world. Thank you, Howard Lyman. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with Animal Voices.
Join us for fun and good times at the Community Living Show every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on CFRO 102.7 FM on your dial. Dealing with today's issues for special needs people throughout BC. The Community Living Show. Don't miss it.